good morning and welcome. Thank you for joining us for, I guess, the third day of, yes, it is the third day of our sixth annual sixth Filson Institute Conference, Heart, Hand of War. And I want to thank you for being here. Some of you have been here, I think, the entire stretch. How many people were here Friday night? How many people were here Thursday night? Yeah. See, now it's beginning to get, it's as foggy as guerrilla warfare right now with me. So, I want to say, first of all, to thank all the speakers and our conveners and the staff here at the Filson for helping us make this possible. I also want to thank the Thomas Walker Bullitt Perpetual Trust, who in part makes this series possible as well, as well as so many of our fellows' fellowships and fellows' programs. So we appreciate their support. It's my pleasure at this time to introduce Aaron Sheehan Dean. His topic this morning, his keynote address, Time Will Tell, What Can We Learn About the Civil War from Modern Conflicts? Aaron Sheehan Dean is the Fred C. Frey Professor at Louisiana State University, and as I mentioned on Thursday, is a co-convener along with Leanne Weitz. He received his bachelor's degree from Northwestern and his master's and PhD degrees from the University of Virginia. He has written many articles and books. Here are a few: A Companion to the U.S. Civil War, his editor, The Civil War, The Final Year, Told by Those Who Lived It, Concise Historical Atlas of the U.S. Civil War, Why Confederates Fought, Family and Nation in Civil War Virginia, and editor two of The Struggle for a Vast Future, The American Civil War. So, Aaron, thanks so much for all you did to help us put this program together, and we appreciate you being here.
Thanks. Good morning. Thank you all for coming. And thanks also to Mark and Judy and everybody at the Filson that has put this on. It's been terrific, and your punctuality is incredible. It was sort of like 9 o'clock exactly on the atomic standard when we started, and all of yesterday's ran right on time, which is great. And it's great to be in such a beautiful place to talk about such awful issues. You know, there's a nice incongruity there. My kids, for a long time, have asked me whether I only read books with blood and death in the title. You know, as I'm sort of, I mean, I'm working on a project on sort of moral considerations of killing in the Civil War, and so they all seem to have something dismal on the front cover. And I have to admit that it gets me down, as I suspect the same is true for many of you, that this topic, considering guerrillas and irregulars and civilians and the boundaries and margins of the war, and also the way in which that, as we are now finding, is the center, and in some respects kind of the essence of the Civil War, that it's a hard topic day in and day out. That being said, it also is important, I think. My one caveat here this morning is that I've been suffering from a cold, and I'm just emerging from my NyQuil haze from last night. I got in early, but if I say something ridiculous, I'm blaming it on the NyQuil. We'll add it to the list of academic embarrassments that became a topic last night as we were all sharing our worst. I'm hoping not to top that list, which kind of grew through the night, of what were the most silly things you'd ever done in your career. For the last 5 years or so, we have heard a great deal about the global turn in U.S. and, yes, even finally, Civil War history. This is a salutary change. Considering the Civil War from from perspectives outside the U.S. and looking out from North America restores the view held by most participants and offers valuable distance on the conflict. Today, I would like to encourage a different kind of reconceptualization, this one chronological rather than spatial. As much as the Civil War as a topic of historical investigation has been geographically bounded, that is, an American conflict, it has been similarly isolated in time. a product of the 1850s, no doubt, and with obvious ramifications for the immediate post-war period. But in general, the Civil War stands marooned from other American conflicts. Whether we view the war as the last of the 18th century gentlemen's conflicts or the first modern war, a dichotomous view that I think this conference is going a long way to disrupting, we rarely subject the conflict to much chronological investigation. The only way to understand the significance and meaning of events and behaviors is to place them in context. That's our charge as historians. And we typically do this by establishing a narrow and well-defined time frame, days, months, years around a surrounding event. And when we wander too far away in time, we're accused of either creating anachronisms or engaging in presentism. We exercise caution in this regard because we know from studies of memory that meaning is slippery. John Brown's raid looked much different in June of 1865 than it did in December of 1859 when it occurred. So we are right to be suspicious of how changes in context may lead us to misinterpret past events. But a legitimate desire to avoid specious analogies should not blind us to the opportunities possible when we learn from the insights of historians of more modern conflicts. I'm not speaking here about the separate but related effort of establishing continuities between the Civil War and later conflicts. A handful of scholars, mostly military historians, do this, and I think this is a beneficial change. It's something that I've written about elsewhere, of trying to situate the Civil War in the longer 19th century. But my purpose today is really to try to leverage the analytical insights and research methods from the study of more modern wars to inform what we do. So what I'm going to do is talk about the experience of more recent wars, in particular the Plains Indian Wars, the Philippine War, World War II, and Vietnam, and consider how those relate to the Civil War. And then I'll try to sort of quickly summarize what this might say about, help us rethink the Civil War. And I'm going to admit up front, this is a kind of dilettante survey. I don't come to this as a historian of modern American military tradition. I have come to the conclusions today basically on reading modern studies and then trying to think about, or studies of more modern wars, the way they resonate with what we do as Civil War historians. So I have no doubt that many of you in the audience know the more modern conflicts much better than I do, so feel free to throw a red flag on the play when you see me saying something or hear me saying something ridiculous. The military conflict that followed more or less continuously from the Civil War were the Plains Indian Wars of the 1860s, 70s, and 80s. And my topic here is not Indian policy, which through Grant's administration oscillated between peaceful and violent approaches, but how the U.S. made war against Indian communities. These conflicts happened over an extended period of time, over a very extended space. And our studies of the Civil War, as we heard yesterday from Zach and Megan, are sort of starting to encompass some of that space as well, which is a very good shift. Non-Western historians, that is those of us who aren't Westernists, tend to characterize this process by chronicling its closing moments, the successful efforts of the U.S. Army to break the power of the Sioux Indians, particularly those led by Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, and then the massacre at Wounded Knee, and that sort of comes in, and then we're off into the Gilded Age. In fact, those Indian wars consist of wars, plural, which occurred over several decades in various locales as the U.S. soldiers sought to conquer and then expel, and often expel, native peoples from their land. Although these conflicts were varied and possessed their own unique tempo and events, they shared many characteristics. And so today I want to rely primarily upon Elliot West's excellent study of the Nez Perce War, which elucidates many of the kind of common characteristics of these Plains Indian Wars of the era. The first point is that just as in the Civil War, we now know, participants in the Indian Wars considered the laws of war. As West shows, Anglo-Americans legitimized their attacks on the Nez Perce by recourse to the same authorities that Northerners used to justify their fight with the Confederacy. The particular issue pressing the U.S. and the Nez Perce toward war was Anglo-settlers' desire for arable and watered land. And West quotes Emer de Vattel, one of the sources upon whom Lieber stood and others. Vattel is a 18th century theologian and writer. Washington's got Vattel's works. Jefferson's got Vattel's works. He's the one who explains the laws of war to Americans, not in English, but nonetheless explains them for sort of the Revolutionary era. And Vattel asserted that people who refused to farm the land and, quote, preyed on their neighbors for their needs deserved to be extirpated as savage and pernicious beasts. So much for protecting noncombatants. Even as Union officials devised a code of conduct for fighting, Francis Lieber distinguished between civilized and barbaric military practices, which, according to some, released American units in the West from observing the restraints that govern fighting in the Civil War. According to Carl Jacoby in his study of the massacre of Apaches at Camp Grant in 1871, quote, although the United States was engaged in two conflicts at the same time in the 1860s, one against the Confederacy and another against Indian peoples in the West, it saw fit to practice quite different forms of total war in these two campaigns. But like Elliot West, Carl Jacoby uses both Lieber and Vattel and these other authorities as ways to understand how the participants are structuring their campaigns. West's chronicle of the Nez Perce War shows us the persecution of an entire people. The fighting, which happened in the summer of 1877, was fragmented and unfocused. West describes, quote, a horrific spasm of murder and brutality, mostly retribution aimed against men and women affiliated with one side, but rarely directed at soldiers. Functionally, the Nez Perce ran an insurgent campaign against settler families because the army, the U.S. Army, remained unbeatable while sequestered in its forts. The nature of the conflict quickly surpassed the worst violence of the Civil War. The U.S. victory at Big Hole in midsummer of 1877 killed dozens of Indian women and children, and then just after this, the Nez Perce found themselves attacked by Montana citizens that they had presumed to be neutral. When they came across civilians in the weeks ahead, West writes, the gloves were off, that is, both sides deliberately targeting noncombatants almost exclusively for long periods of the summer. The Civil War offers no parallel to this systematic targeting of noncombatants, and targeting not in terms of property destruction, an issue that we began talking about yesterday, but targeting with lethal violence. Nonetheless, this comparison dramatizes our need for much more precise accounting of the selectivity exercised by combatants during the Civil War. And this is particularly important for those places where irregular fighting occurred. Michael Fellman's study of Missouri, which has exerted enormous influence on scholars inside and outside the field, emphasizes the terror, fear, confusion, and unpredictability sown by partisan violence. And in some respects, certainly for scholars that are not 19th century specialists, Fellman's book really stands as the commentary on guerrilla war and the Civil War. Although Fellman noted in his introduction and conclusion that Missourians did not become monsters, his narrative catalogs one monstrous event after another. The cumulative effect suggests that the guerrilla conflicts existed beyond planning, beyond reason, beyond logic. But even our own experiences with terror reveal patterns and causes. Andrew Fialka, some of whose work we heard about yesterday, is one of those people trying to find the rationality, the planning in guerrilla war. Despite all the fine work that has been done on guerrillas, I am not convinced that we yet really understand who could be killed and when, under what conditions, by guerrillas during the Civil War. During the Nez Perce conflict, U.S. soldiers targeted not enemy soldiers on battlefields, but a people in their homes and in flight. This is partly because those Nez Perce and the band itself split, so half agreed to a sort of expulsion order from the U.S. government and another half resisted. Those Nez Perce who resisted the government's expulsion order moved as a unit. The prevailing Indian framework of military conflict did not segregate home front and battlefront the way American practice did. This cultural difference produced profound ramifications. Indian warriors' decision to return to their families after engagements did not signal their willingness to accept their wives and children as legitimate targets, but that is precisely how many U.S. soldiers interpreted their actions. Some U.S. soldiers in pursuit of the Nez Perce likened it to a kind of siege, a siege of a mobile city. They knew women and children were being harmed in their attacks, but because they could only sporadically draw Indian soldiers themselves into battle, they accepted the civilian casualties and blamed those on the Indian men. Although we rarely acknowledge this point, the shared military inheritance in North and South helped ensure a more restrained conflict in the Civil War. With the exception of emancipation and the enlistment of black soldiers, and that's an important exception, the people of the Union and the Confederacy understood war itself in similar ways. They drew on the same European examples to conceptualize the boundaries of their behavior. In contrast, the absence of a shared framework for understanding the nature and purpose of war complicated every American engagement with native peoples. The Civil War equivalent to the attacks on these Nez Perce encampments, it seems to me, are sieges. How did Civil War soldiers think about the civilian casualties incurred in the process of conquering southern towns, where they are conquering southern people, men, women, and children, as well as, and in a different way than, the battles on designated battlefields? In general, the experience from the Civil War reinforced established attitudes about sieges and about the moral responsibility for noncombatant lives that had traditionally been adhered, according to people like Vittel and other commentators. Henry Halleck, who's one of these commentators, Halleck publishes a very important treatise on international law in 1861 that sort of brings together a lot of the established authorities, beginning from a very early stage. I mean, the Bible is often cited in there, all the way through Grotius, Francesco de Vitoria, and other authorities. For graduate students, it's a model of CYA with footnotes. He sort of does a paragraph, and then at least as long of a paragraph of citations of people to go see in the sort of fuzzy, I'm not giving you a page, just read Vittel, and then you'll know that what I'm arguing is proper. So good practice for us. He summarized the prevailing sentiment regarding culpability for civilian casualties as a result of a siege. Quote, every besieged place is, for the time, a military post. For even when it is not defended by a military garrison, its inhabitants are converted into soldiers by the necessities of self-defense. End quote. As a result, civilian deaths were legitimate under the doctrine of what comes to be called double effect. That's not a phrase that he used, but modern theorists of just war refer to it that way. As a result, this theory came into play at several points throughout the war. For nearly a year in the middle of the Civil War, the residents of Vicksburg, Mississippi, bunkered themselves within Confederate military lines. According to the laws of war then and now, John C. Pemberton, the commanding Confederate general at Vicksburg, accepted the responsibility for civilian casualties because he failed to evacuate residents before the arrival of the Union Army, which besieged the city in June of 1863. From outside those lines, Grant explained the situation to his wife, Julia. Everything looks highly favorable here now. I have the town closely invested, and our rifle pits up so close to the enemy that they cannot show their heads without being shot at. They dare not show a single gun on the whole line of their works. By throwing shells every few minutes, the people are kept continuously in their caves. They must give out soon, even if their provisions do not give out. Troops are on less than half rations and many poor people without anything. I decline allowing any of them to come out. Now, this is a harsh but neither unusual nor unlawful practice under the laws of war. Once the siege begins, you do not let people out. The commander has the option to surrender at the beginning, and he didn't, that is, Pemberton didn't, and so the consequences fall on him. Similarly, outside Atlanta in 1864, Sherman blamed the Confederate decision to retreat into the city itself for civilian casualties. Confederates, he wrote, defended Atlanta on a line so close to town that every cannon shot and many musket shot from our line of investment that overshot their mark went into the habitations of women and children. John Bell Hood, the Confederate commander, presented two faces to the conflict. During the bombardment, he never petitioned Sherman to stop shelling the town. And this silence is surprising. He had the time and the skill. Hood wielded his pen effectively in the post-war era. But his failure to comment on the question of the legality of the bombardment while it occurred suggests he knew that he held responsibility for civilian deaths because of his position in and around the city. Only once his army had been forced to retreat did he condemn Sherman, and all he criticized him for was failing to notify residents that he would be shelling the town. Something that didn't come as a surprise to anyone. He argued that Union misfiring was not accidental. Quote, I have too good an opinion, founded upon both observation and experience, of the skill of your artillerists to credit the insinuation that they for several weeks unintentionally fired too high for my modest field works and slaughtered women and children by accident and want of skill. And Hood was correct. Sherman was deliberately sending shells into the town, not just into the line of Confederate troops in front. But Hood is guilty of misrepresenting the reality here as well. During weeks of shelling, only 20 or so civilians died. Not quite a slaughter. Stephen Davis has been doing work on this lately and has a couple of good articles and a longer book about the decision to siege this town. This is different from the decision, the issue that Lisa was discussing yesterday, Lisa Frank's paper on the expulsion order, which happens afterwards. In some respects, we can't get as clear a reading on the kind of moral questions of this decision because they're hopelessly clouded by the expulsion order. That's where all of the kind of heat in this tends to be. And in fact, from a laws of war perspective, this one strikes me as more important. That is the question of besieging the city and potentially subjecting the civilians there to huge casualties. After the fall of Atlanta, Hood and Sherman debated the campaign sequence in the newspapers. Hood, like some modern authors, criticized Sherman for failing to notify residents that the town would be shelled. Even this, Sherman refused to accept. "I was not bound by the laws of war to give notice of the shelling," Sherman lectured. He probably was, but... "A fortified town with magazines, arsenals, foundries, and public stores, you were bound to take notice. See the books." Right? That is, go read Lieber and Vittel and these other folks. Hood admitted, this question came up yesterday about Lieber. All of them had read Lieber. The Confederates read Lieber very carefully. Once those orders were published, the Confederates respond with a 157-point rebuttal. And they ignore all of the kind of measures of restraint in the Lieber Code and then focus on all those measures that they perceive as facilitating atrocities and unjust acts. So that document is parsed very carefully by the Confederate High Command, and Sherman, no doubt, was quite familiar with it as well. But in response, then, Hood actually admits as much in one of his responses to Sherman, noting, quote, "I made no complaint of your firing into Atlanta in any way you thought proper." Sieges are one of these flashpoints where Civil War soldiers subjected enemy civilians, true noncombatants, directly to lethal force, and we would do well to investigate these episodes more carefully from a laws of war perspective. The legality of sieges notwithstanding, it is certainly true that many American soldiers did not discriminate between legitimate and illegitimate targets in their war against the Nez Perce. Some carried prejudicial attitudes toward Indians with them to the West, and others developed a hard shell of animosity as a result of the style of fighting that they faced there. Regardless, the suffering of Indian noncombatants rarely penetrated deeply enough to generate sympathy or restraint. Race, no doubt, played a major role here. This is the central explanation that Mark Neely offered for the varied conduct of soldiers in the Civil War. And while it may be oversimplifying to claim, as Neely did, that Northern whites manifested mercy and kindness to Southern civilians because of their shared racial heritage, it is also clear that the boundaries established by common consent in the Civil War did not apply in the Indian Wars that followed. During the Civil War, Union soldiers fought alongside black men, and many of these Northern men, it is now clear, developed a grudging respect for people of color, both slave and free. At the same time, other Union soldiers only seemed to deepen in their dislike of black Americans. The racial battle lines of the Indian Wars presented a much clearer field of combat. White men were now joined together, though, of course, the Federal Army in the 1870s was overwhelmingly Northern, with not a few African Americans in it. And they faced brown-skinned people who refused to adhere to the civilizational model so generously promulgated by the federal government. This fact alone liberated some soldiers to wage a war without restraint. The result was a sequence of atrocities on a scale at least 10 times worse than anything experienced during the Civil War. So an abbreviated list: Bear River in 1863, 280 dead. Sand Creek in 1864, 140 dead. Camp Grant in 1871, 120 dead. Wounded Knee in 1890, 250. Many of the victims in those, that grim catalog, women and children. And this, I think, demonstrates an important difference in scale between these conflicts. And this is something that we sometimes lose in discussions of the Civil War, and I'm not suggesting that some of the atrocities there aren't significant or that we should pay more attention solely on the basis of numbers. But that scale suggests something about the restraint that's exercised in the Civil War, even in the midst of the most awful moments. And this difference is not due entirely to race, either, in those Indian Wars. As West, Carl Jacoby, and others have shown, American soldiers felt justified in using brutal methods partly because of how Indians fought, that is, the nature of the combat, not solely the kind of characteristics of those people whom they were fighting. The Philippine War, a phrasing to describe basically the second and important half of the Spanish-American War. That war, and those of you who teach the survey generally, you know, it takes about 20 minutes in a survey, if that, to kind of cover the Spanish War, and off you go. You know, the easiest way is to quote Sherwood Anderson, who wrote, "It was like robbing the old, like, what did he say? It's like robbing the old gypsy lady at night after the fair is closed." Not a very honorable or difficult kind of event. The Filipino context of that conflict was much more serious and much more severe and dragged on for years and involved thousands of American casualties and tens of thousands of Philippine casualties. It's the first military conflict after the Civil War that Americans considered a bona fide war, as opposed to the Indian conflicts, which tended to be passed off as some kind of security action. After Admiral Dewey's easy and early victory at Manila Bay, American efforts to control the islands generated a terrific backlash from the Filipino-led independence movement, whose leaders had expected the expulsion of the Spanish to bring home rule. What developed instead was a bitter guerrilla conflict waged by Filipino independence fighters. The American counterinsurgency strategy balanced protecting friendly communities with punitive measures against guerrillas. One historian of the conflict explains U.S. behavior as determined by the Civil War's General Orders No. 100, arguing that the Libre Code, quote, balanced restraint on the occupier's part, which must be met by reciprocal restraint in the subject population. And if such restraint from the subjects was not forthcoming, and it wasn't in the Philippines, the U.S. Army empowered itself to conduct brutal counterstrikes against suspected guerrillas. One of the differences between the conflicts, that is, between the Civil War and the Philippine War, is how the resource differential between the two combatants encouraged what political scientists refer to today as an asymmetrical conflict. The Battle of Manila in early 1899 was such an overwhelming American victory against the main Philippine Army of Liberation, as it was called, that it discouraged more such conventional conflicts in the future. Instead, as one reporter noted at the time, it created concern among War Department officials that, quote, the Filipinos may take to the interior of the country, practically impassable for American troops in the approaching rainy season, and that a prolonged Indian fighting style of campaign may follow, end quote. Reading backward from this experience suggests that one of the stabilizing factors of the Civil War was the fact that the Confederacy possessed the size, the resources, and the organization to mount regular campaigns. The regular battlefield conflicts that dominate the literature in the U.S. Civil War were bloody and awful, but generally managed according to the laws of war. The violence of these clashes was almost always directed against uniformed soldiers. The exceptions came late in the war and usually involved black soldiers. There were important cultural factors that influenced the decision to fight in a traditional manner. Honor and the related public adherence to a tradition of European-style military conflict, most importantly. But the bottom line is that the more regular fighting, the less irregular fighting, and thus the fewer non-combatants harmed. A regular civil war was hardly inevitable. We should recall the serious discussion among Lee's lieutenants about shifting to a guerrilla war after Appomattox. Edward Porter Alexander, the chief of artillery for the Army of Northern Virginia, urged this on his colleagues as the army was moving away from Richmond. Had enough Confederate leaders followed his advice, the body count for the Civil War would surely have skyrocketed dramatically. Civil War historians have generally been loath to deploy the analytical frameworks from later conflicts, so a word like asymmetrical probably strikes many of you as anachronistic here. My point is not to apply contemporary labels to the Civil War to domesticize it, but to use the underlying logic of more modern methods if they can shed new light. In some regions, the Civil War was an asymmetrical conflict. After the Confederate Army pulled out of Arkansas in 1862 and Governor Thomas Hindman issued his famous Band of Ten order, that region operated in a way quite similar to what we see in modern insurgencies. Small groups with no general or unified command structure attacking detachments of the incumbents and their civilian supporters, that is, Unionists. But as a descriptor for the conflict as a whole, asymmetrical doesn't work. And for Civil War Americans, that was a very good thing. Because asymmetrical conflicts are characterized by irregular fighting, the boundary between military and civilian is much blurrier and leaves many more people vulnerable to military violence. The Philippine War reporter that I quoted a minute ago foresaw that war accurately. As the war moved south through the islands, it encompassed more brutal guerrilla fighting alongside efforts by the U.S. military to split the Filipino population. This approach should sound familiar to Civil War historians. The Army began reconstruction during the conflict, partly by encouraging ethnic differences along which lines the U.S. could secure civilian loyalty. Soldiers tried not to alienate civilians, and particularly wealthy Filipino landowners often eagerly accepted U.S. protection of their property in exchange for turning in or rejecting the help of guerrillas. Lower Mississippi Valley in 1862, anyone? But of course, other people, those that refused to take this opportunity of loyalty to the U.S., suffered because of the Army's destructive power and particularly its seizure of food. Talk that Robert Goodmanset gave yesterday, right? There's a lot of parallels here. Filipino independence fighters committed gross atrocities against collaborators, and American soldiers retaliated in kind whenever they could actually capture the guerrillas. The tactic of dividing a region's populace along ethnic lines by currying favor with friendly groups was a key characteristic of the Plains Indian Wars as well. We have a number of excellent ethnic histories of the Civil War, but these focus almost exclusively on the social experience of particular groups, what happens to Germans or Irish as they, their social experience in America as a whole. We rarely connect ethnicity to military action as a criteria for encouraging peace or violence. I believe that we could profit from analyzing how ethnicity shaped the way soldiers treated enemy civilians. If you've read Confederate reports as they moved into, as Lee's army moved into Pennsylvania in both, well, into Maryland in 62, but particularly into Pennsylvania in 63, all of the denunciations of the damned Dutch as they turn up suggest that Confederate soldiers saw these people as fundamentally different from other Americans, and I suspect slightly more vulnerable. The physical descriptions that soldiers give of these people see them as strange and hostile. One soldier I remember wrote about the Confederate women as being all sinewy and gross. Right? I mean, these are sort of farm women. They look exactly like Virginia farm women. That is, they're generally pretty tough. But he sort of perceives this because he knows that Pennsylvania is the land of the Dutch, that these women are now sort of physically, they actually look different. Brian Lynn has written the most thorough military history of the Filipino conflict. In that book, he takes to task previous historians who have, in his view, overemphasized the atrocities that Americans committed in their efforts to suppress the independence movement. Lynn critiques other historians regarding what he calls the atrocity issue, a strangely amoral kind of shorthand. He explains away executions as most often retaliatory, excuse me, and spends more time on the question of what was then called the water cure. This was a form of waterboarding conducted by American units, lavishly photographed and discussed in detail. If you'd like this information about it, it's widely available. And it's ironically defended, it's a policy defended and articulated by the man who went on to basically rewrite Lieber's code for the modern 20th century army to kind of put all those rules of restraint in order. He was the guy that sort of legitimized the water cure. Lynn's explanation of why torture occurred echoes the bad apples theory that some commentators have used to account for U.S. soldiers' abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib. Soldiers who tortured Filipino insurgents, Lynn writes, did so because of their, quote, isolation and distance from support, their frequent and prolonged exposure to combat, and their dependence on immediate information. Now, I'm not fully persuaded by Lynn's psychological explanation, though this approach can yield valuable insights, as I think Katie Thompson's work will show us this afternoon. Nonetheless, I believe we should emulate Lynn's direct confrontation of this problem. The challenge for us is how do we explain the atrocities of the Civil War? Why did they happen? Thanks to recent work, they appear more common than we have previously appreciated, but are they ultimately representative of the conflict's real nature or something marginal and exceptional to the war itself? Perhaps we should discard this binary framing altogether, recognizing that the Civil War encompassed both regular and irregular combat, strict adherence to the laws of war, and gross atrocities. Recent work has turned a light on these darker corners of the Civil War, and many of these studies do so not to sensationalize, but to understand in the context of the time how these events have occurred. I think we need more of this work. Kevin Levin's study of the Battle of the Crater, one of several massacres by black soldiers by white Confederates, emphasizes what he calls the long narrative of slave insurrection and the perceived threat to a social, political, and economic hierarchy based on white supremacy. Levin's close reading of the contemporary sources offers an explanation jarring to modern sensibilities, but intelligible to the historical actors themselves. He quotes a South Carolina soldier who explained after the battle that the sight of black soldiers, quote, had the same effect upon our men that a red flag had upon a mad bull. Levin's explanation is a cultural one. For him, collective violence directed against black men allowed, quote, allowed Confederates to vent their fury in the face of what they perceived to be a racial order turned upside down. Other scholars of racial atrocities emphasize culture as well. Gregory Irwin's excellent collection, Black Flag Over Dixie, if you want to really ruin your afternoon, you can read that, provides the most comprehensive survey of racial atrocities in the Civil War. And these are all across the Confederacy. There's, I think, 10 or 11 chapters in there, each of them a different one in a different state. In his introduction, Irwin expresses the kernel of the problem with admirable clarity, the Confederate denial of civilian immunity. That is, civilians are immune from the lethal force applied by armies. And this applied to surrendering black soldiers as well. The process of surrendering essentially moved your status from a soldier into something much more akin to a non-combatant. That is, you should have been protected. The contributors to Ehrman's collection attribute the decision of Confederates to murder black soldiers to racial hatred. And I would say this is a kind of slippery explanation and one that can bear more insight. Race isn't always the determining factor in the Civil War's atrocities, as we know. The Great Hanging at Gainesville, Texas, the Shelton Laurel Massacre in North Carolina, and Quantrill's raid on Lawrence all transpired between white men. And further, even at many of the racial atrocities that Ehrman's contributors chronicle, other factors played key roles. At Fort Pillow, the presence of loyal white Tennessean troops enraged the attacking Confederates. And the fighting at the crater, of course, was triggered by the detonation of an enormous mine that instantly killed several hundred Confederates in what they regarded as a gross violation of the laws of war. So in addition to culture, which I'm not dismissing here by any means, I think it's important for us to integrate a fuller and more detailed assessment of these events. Some atrocities emerged in more haphazard and contingent circumstances. What little we know about torture in the Civil War seems to fit this model. Both armies executed captured spies summarily, usually in the field after a brief hearing, and undoubtedly some of these men were tortured to determine what they knew. But such practices appear to be relatively infrequent compared to the more prevalent modern use of torture. So in the 20th century Ireland and Algeria, for instance, imperial powers, Britain and France, respectively, institutionalized torture as a routine form of warfare. That's something that never happens in the Civil War, and it's important to think about why it doesn't, I think. As historians investigate social and community relations in more detail, we may learn more about torture and other violent practices. For instance, some Pennsylvania counties use thumbscrews against bounty jumpers. One well-documented instance involved the use of torture against deserter bands and unionists in North Carolina. Still more remarkable in this case was the use of such techniques against a woman. A Confederate unit seeking information about a deserter band tied Mary Owen's thumbs together behind her back and hoisted her off the ground until she revealed the hidden location of her husband's camp. Barton Myers, the author who has so ably unpacked this complicated case, explained this behavior as politically motivated, politically legitimated personal violence. Indeed, the perpetrators did not hide, but instead proudly boasted of their conduct. The colonel in charge of the operation defended his men's behavior to a lawyer sent by the governor to investigate the episode. The colonel believed that he had followed the governor's earlier injunction to, quote, place the brand upon them, that is, deserters, and their spouses, and make them feel the scorn and contempt of an outraged people. I would say that Mary Owen isn't a deserter, but she's an active participant, as Leanne was suggesting the first night, in helping sustain those deserter bands, just as much as guerrillas are dependent upon households. Deserter bands are equally, if not more so, dependent upon those household systems of support. So Barton's explanation here differs from the cultural framework common to so many of the war's racial atrocities, his explanation of it as politically motivated and politically legitimated personal violence. My purpose is not to laud any particular analytical approach. I think we need all of these, and we need to investigate these episodes as carefully as possible, not simply stop at race as the explanation. That's undoubtedly a part of the context here. But so many of these episodes in the Civil War could have gone one way or another, and our challenge is figuring out why. The problem of atrocity and responsibility segues into a similar issue in World War II, though one that occurred in a much broader setting, bombing and civilian exposure. The advent of air power in World War II is commonly taken to mark a dividing line between the more limited wars of the 19th century and the horrors of the 20th, notwithstanding the enormous loss of civilian life in World War I. But partitioning these conflicts into different eras assumes the very problem we must solve. How, why, and when do attitudes about civilian vulnerability in war change over time? The basic issue confronting the Allies and the Germans was the same one that Sherman faced as he marched to the sea in 1864, where to direct the devastation of war and to what extent non-combatants should suffer in the pursuit of victory. Possessing the technology to kill on a larger scale does not alter the moral dynamic. But the decision by the Allied governments to bomb civilian centers, especially Dresden, Tokyo, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki, reflected a new calculus about moral agency in warfare. What forces compelled American war planners to disregard earlier traditions of directing wartime killing only against military targets? Certainly, both Americans and the British felt a desire for revenge against the German bombings that killed tens of thousands of Britons in the war's early years. Air Force planners made economic and infrastructural arguments as well, that the nature of industrial war in the mid-20th century made industrial facilities and their surrounding areas a legitimate target. But on a deeper level, the use of air power to bomb urban centers across Europe was predicated on a new vision of popular war. That is, modern wars waged with broad civilian support, even in what we regard as non-democratic states. Rather than the imperial ventures initiated and sustained by the will of a monarch in previous centuries. From such a perspective, a strategic, and I'll use that word in quotes, bombing campaign could compel citizens to push its government toward peace. As Richard Overy notes, quote, the more governments depended on the support of the governed, the more the morale and resources of the civilian population became a legitimate object of attack. This was the motive, Overy argues, for Allied commanders who planned the bombing of Bulgaria in 1944, as its government toggled between its early war alliance with Germany and the emerging power of the Soviets. Historians disagree about whether campaigns of this sort were successful in World War II. Bombing attacks could sometimes create solidarity among bombing's victims against the perpetrators, and in other cases, wear people out to the point that they were happy for peace without regard to the consequences. The parallel case in the Civil War concerns the response of white Southerners to the hard war campaign engineered by Grant and Sherman and Porter and others. Jacqueline Campbell's study of South Carolina, Lisa Frank's study of Georgia, and my own work in Virginia all suggest not drawing any easy conclusions about the deterioration of Southern will because of hard war tactics. There's little question that Sherman hastened the war's end by denying Southerners the resources to fight, but I've seen little evidence that this effort spurred the kind of large-scale disaffection he was hoping to inspire. But the larger question continues to merit attention. How did Northerners' attitudes about Southern civilians and their support of the war, that is, their political beliefs and their political support, shape military policies? The American experience in the Pacific Theater sheds light on this question as well. John Dower's War Without Mercy offers the boldest explanation for why the war followed the course, that is, the Pacific War, followed the course that it did, emphasizing the racial hatred of Americans and Japanese. Racist images of the enemy saturated the popular and military media of both America and Japan, producing soldiers on both sides driven by dreams of revenge and an absolute refusal to surrender. Most of the violence, Dower describes, was perpetrated by American soldiers against Japanese soldiers, not civilians, but the motives he ascribes derive broadly from American perceptions of Japanese people. Of particular importance in this regard, in shaping the attitudes of U.S. soldiers towards the Japanese, were a series of films produced by Frank Capra, and Dower singles out Know Your Enemy, Japan, as one of the most important. In his analysis of the film, Dower describes the struggle among the filmmakers over how to assign blame for the war. Capra and the army advisors to the film perceive the Japanese people as uniquely militaristic and bloodthirsty, while scriptwriters, many of them more politically liberal, wanted to highlight the role of the Japanese leaders. Capra and the army won this fight, and so the films broadly kind of demonize the Japanese people, and of course we've spent decades undoing the visual representations of the Japanese that they so skillfully promoted. This issue, how did participants in the war understand its origins and who should they hold responsible, has an important parallel in the field in Civil War historiography. Though we don't always connect the subfield to the issue of wartime violence, many scholars have studied Northern and Southern conceptualizations of the enemy. We have, I hope, put behind us the image of a brothers' war, but it is certainly clear that Lincoln and Seward believed that well-intentioned Southern Unionists comprised a majority in many states. They and others in the administration believed that the war was driven by a power-hungry and paranoid slaveocracy that could be defeated by having its leaders and their fear-mongering arguments exposed, that is, the attitude of the scriptwriters in Capra's film. The works of Stephen Ashe and Mark Grimsley, as well as a host of studies of individual armies and units, confirms that many Northern soldiers came south with the same expectation, only to find bitter opposition from most Southern whites. Union soldiers, long before Lincoln and Seward, gave up on the idea that the Confederate High Command, that capturing the Confederate High Command would win the war. They came to believe they were fighting a hostile people. This shift, in Grimsley's account, is responsible for the increasingly callous attitude of Northern soldiers against Southern civilians. Dower's description of World War II, as well as the contrary experience of the Civil War, highlights the complex interplay between popular attitudes and soldiers' behavior in the field and suggests the importance of finding ways to control the latter. Today, we assume that the Uniform Code of Military Justice provides such a deterrent to ensure that soldiers follow military guidelines regarding noncombatants. During the Vietnam War, and I'm on my last example, and it's shorter than the previous ones, don't worry. During the Vietnam War, JAG officers prosecuted tens of thousands of soldiers in court-martials and non-judicial punishments. But the number convicted of serious crimes was tiny. In Vietnam, between 1965 and 1972, the Army tried 103 soldiers for murdering Vietnamese civilians. 40 were convicted, 20 convicted of lesser charges, and 38 acquitted. So 2.8 million soldiers in country, and 65 men are convicted in some measure of killing civilians. Charges for other serious crimes against civilians numbered 90, of whom half were convicted. According to one study of the system, quote, if the military justice system is indeed supposed to be a deterrent, then it did indeed fail. This author, William Allison, focused more on violence internal to the Army, such as fragging, but if the U.S. Army couldn't protect its own officers, what chance did Vietnamese civilians stand? His study offers little support for the belief that the military justice system protected Vietnamese civilians or sought justice in any reliable way for violations of war by U.S. soldiers. The origins of that JAG system lie in the Civil War. Did it work better then? This is a very hard question to answer for the Civil War, as many of you know. But let me present a few numbers based on one subset for which we have complete information. That is, soldiers convicted of serious crimes against civilians. During the Civil War, the U.S. Army executed 263 men. 181 of those, or almost 70%, for desertion. There were only 87 cases of men convicted of committing violent crimes, mostly murder and rape. And almost half of the murders concerned other service members. Two serious problems, so fragging is not unique to Vietnam, that's one of the things we learn looking at this collection here. Two serious problems present themselves even with this bounded data set, that is, the soldiers executed by the U.S. in the Civil War. First, the number of rapes, 23, clearly undercounts the incidence of this crime, particularly against black women, who were, according to all of the investigations, and there haven't been very many of this topic, suffered a much higher incidence of this crime against them than white women in the South. Second, prosecutions were disproportionately directed against men of color. 35 of the 87 men executed for serious crimes were black soldiers. This subset of cases, the executions, ignores the vastly larger prosecution of crimes at the regimental level. So there were no doubt men charged with murder and rape who were convicted of lesser crimes at the regimental level. So there's better prosecution than the 87 I'm chronicling here. But none of those were executed, and it's hard to know for various reasons, how many of those there were. Regardless, this cursory evaluation, as well as the evidence for more careful studies of discipline in the Civil War, like Lorian Foote's excellent study or Stephen Ramold's Barring the Iron Hand of Discipline, indicate that the Army policed internal violence much more aggressively than it did violence against civilians. In the Civil War, the military's criminal justice system served largely to reinforce Army efficiency rather than provide justice to civilians. Even this quick episodic survey of American wars suggests, I hope, the utility of broadening our comparative frameworks for thinking about the nature of Civil War violence. The Civil War may have been the bloodiest of our conflicts by one standard, that is, the most absolute numbers killed. The Mexican War actually had a higher mortality rate. But it was not unique in the sorts of challenges it posed to participants. How should soldiers treat injured combatants? How should they treat non-combatants? What should they do with guerrillas and other insurgents, and what was the responsibility of citizens when their armies fought unjustly? All of these problems, which recur throughout American and global military history, demand our attention as citizens as well as historians. My goal here is not to establish an absolute scale of lawful and restrained warfare so that we can sort of position the Civil War relative to other conflicts. Instead, I think we can benefit from reading accounts of other conflicts and thinking about how those episodes compare to the Civil War. And as my talk suggests, doing so may help us see the conflict in a new light. Some of my conclusions are obvious, almost banal, but nonetheless significant, I think, for all that. It is important, crucially important, that both sides conceptualized war in the same way, and fortunate that the Confederacy had the means and intellectual desire to fight a regular war as opposed to an irregular conflict. Other conclusions are tentative or merely suggestive, that we need a much closer accounting of sieges, of atrocities, and of military justice. Just as a global perspective can illuminate the similarities and differences between the Civil War and other 19th century conflict, so too a comparative chronological perspective can shed new light on the conflict. Doing so reveals a war that was in some ways more just and in others more brutal than we had previously imagined. Thank you. outrageous.
Yes, well, you did ruin our work. and at the risk of ruining it a little bit more, I'll just dive in. It occurred to me when you were talking about torture, sort of how we are reckoning with the violence of slavery here. Because it seems like, I was sort of thinking this through, it seems like that the use of violence within the system of slavery is so perpetual and likely to spill out of that institution in ways that look a lot like torture. And the extent to which, you know, this image of, you know, thumbscrews and however, yeah, again, not to be too graphic, but however you want to think about the use of sort of random violence to accomplish certain ends. I'm just sort of wondering whether, you know, whether it's worthwhile thinking about the use of violence within the system of slavery as somehow sort of triggering or sort of transferring into new modes at this moment. And for instance, you know, if we think about sort of the instrumentality of that in terms of its objective of subordinating, you know, a labor force or maintaining racial discipline or whatever else that stretches, you know, so far throughout American history. What changes with the perception of slaves as potential allies of the Union effort? Is there a categorical sort of shift? And so the things that used to sort of constitute just sort of discipline of human property sort of shifts into sort of something else that's more like?
Yeah, I mean, this is a crucially important, it's a crucially important question. You know, studies of, in the 1960s and 70s, there was a spate of sociologists that studied kind of American violence, and the question was, are Americans more violent than other people? And they were very concerned about this, and their general answer was no, not really. I mean, notwithstanding the, you know, the death by gun violence in the United States and the rates comparatively. What they didn't well account for, being sociologists, not historians, is the impact of slavery, and the kind of pervasiveness of violence, of personal, intimate violence that's, as Bob says, sort of predicated on labor control across the American South. So I would argue that there is a very different relationship. I mean, there's much more institutional knowledge. You know, you actually have iron prong collars sort of around that you can get, or your blacksmith knows how to put one together in a jiffy. Nobody in Massachusetts knows how to do this. They just don't, right? I mean, they've lost touch with that technology and the use of torture. There is, I mean, it's also important, I think, to point out that there is, of course, a widespread use of what we would kind of regard as torture in the Union Army. They don't use thumbscrews. Guys are hung up sometimes. They're put on barrels. I mean, the disciplinary efforts. Sometimes guys are whipped. That is, soldiers convicted of violating things. But certainly, there is a perception, I think, among... it gets very complicated when soldiers are subjected to discipline that was reserved for slaves. This is a particularly demeaning kind of experience. I mean, in fact, for many men, being in the army was demeaning because it meant reminding them of being slaves. They had to wear a uniform. They had to have a pass. They had men telling them what to do. So, I mean, there's almost no aspect of the war in which kind of racial knowledge and culture mediated by slavery doesn't shape how people are experiencing this. But I think you're absolutely right that particularly the use of torture and the ways in which people understood that interpersonal violence was conditioned by thinking about it in terms of slavery. I mean, what's most remarkable to me about the violence of the Civil War is its absence as enslaved people free themselves. They don't turn the tables. I mean, we have no reports of people subjecting masters. Every once in a while, a guy gets whipped. I mean, there's sort of two verifiable episodes of a master being whipped by his former slaves, usually in the presence of a Union Army company, and we quote them all the time because they're so rich in terms of you know, historical justice. But I've never seen an episode at all of enslaved people committing kind of torture against masters. And it's rare that they even murder them. I mean, this was the great thing, the great slave revolt that didn't happen, whether it is, as Stephanie McCurry and others argue, a slave rebellion. It's clearly not Haiti. It's not Nat Turner. It's not what white Southerners have been predicting since the beginning of the conflict over slavery, which is if you empower black men with arms, there's going to be an uprising and mass killing. It could have been. There's no reason why the Civil War couldn't have spun out like Haiti. And then 620,000 would have seemed a modest level of dead because we would have been talking about millions. If it's, you know, internal to every Southern household in a place where African Americans have access to power, which they did in many places. I think there are both important parallels, and then there are some interesting questions that we've not yet explored at all related to slavery and violence and the war as a whole. In the back there, yeah. Yes, I mean, it's a condition of modern war. That is, if we define modern war, and I'm not getting a total war here, but modern conflicts as popular wars. You know, there's a debate about whether the French Revolution is the first truly modern popular war or the Civil War. I'm a Civil War historian, so I vote for the Civil War. But that is, it is a people's conflict in which the leadership of these respective communities can draw on a base of civilian support. So then, how do you encourage that leadership to give up without alienating? I mean, we started to talk about this yesterday, the kind of political imperative on the half of the Lincoln administration feels continuously, which is there is a political purpose to this that's reunion, and the more widespread our destruction and the more civilians who are either impoverished or starved or even killed, the harder becomes our task of reunifying the country. We recognize this now, and even if it's not a truly democratic state, we sort of recognize, you know, the people of Afghanistan aren't going anywhere, right? They will always be there. So it's important that we not alienate the people of Afghanistan. What we would like is a different set of policies out of the government of Afghanistan. And to do that, we have to somehow pinpoint our violence. It's very hard to do. I mean, it was frankly easier, it seems to me, in the centuries before popular war when, you know, you could sort of just blame it all on the monarch and not kind of worry about having to at the same time wage a hard war and then sort of cultivate civilian support against those people among whom you're committing, you know, you're waging war. And I mean, it's a good thing, obviously. I'm pro-democracy. I'm not calling for the return of monarchs. But you're absolutely right that it makes contemporary conflicts, that is sort of 19th and 20th and 21st century conflicts, much more complicated, particularly for armies to fight, as well as it makes for us to kind of conceptualize who it is that we're fighting against. I mean, Syria is even more confusing, you know, because there's a civil war going on there, and there's a dictator, and there are different states involved. I mean, it's got tremendous difficulties for how do we then devise policies and scale the violence that we commit as a part of the war, keeping those political goals in mind. Stephen.
Yes, thank you. This is some really, I think, some terrific directions, and it shows we've got a lot of ways we can go, and particularly the connection between the Indian Wars and the Philippines. I think the racial dynamic works really well. But I was curious as whether you think we could push that further and during the Civil War see not just race and racism, but essentially that also motivating brutality against what I guess I will call the enemies of white supremacy. The Jayhawkers in Lawrence, Lincolnites in Kentucky, like you heard about yesterday. And can we push that a little further, do you think, understanding that it's not going to answer all our questions?
Yeah, we can. I mean, Lauren and I were talking about this yesterday, about thinking about sort of the civilizational model of warfare. I mean, and one of the things that it has occurred to me in looking at this is that in many respects, the North in particular tries to position itself as like Great Britain. That is, a restrained, a civilized world community, a civilized community leading the world towards, you know, democracy and better things. And even in war, that they wage war the proper way. And this is a kind of natural position of leadership. On the other hand, of course, there's the kind of dark side of this, which is that in the 19th century, the advance of civilization sometimes meant extirpating savagery and doing it as a kind of necessary component of that process. So Americans look at the Sepoy Rebellion of 1857, in which the British brutally suppressed the Indian nationalist uprising there. And for many of them, I mean, it flips in variety of ways, that is, people use this rhetoric in different ways, but for many white Northerners, this is part of what establishing civilization around the world requires. Some of them are kind of vaguely wistful in a Jeffersonian sort of way. Well, it's too bad, you know, the Indians won't be around, but in the meantime, I'm going to execute a policy that literally will destroy them, not kind of accidentally do that, right? And so I think that 19th century civilizational model does have important ramifications for how you wage war, particularly in these racial terms that you're talking about, that it is, even as you celebrate your virtue, it's predicated on a kind of hierarchical model of race and of what the world is going to look like in 100 years or 200 years. And we, of course, don't have that model anymore, so that one serves to highlight how different this war is. Leslie.
And this perception that the so-called rules have been broken, and this perception of people living this war, that this is horrific. So I'm just wondering, what do you do with that? And I appreciate your point that we need to be thinking comparatively. What do you make of that, which seems to be where a lot of scholarship has been going right now, in making us aware of this? For the people of the time, this isn't us. This is the modern day sensibility. This is what the people of the time tell us.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, there is, of course, a rhetoric of atrocity that begins almost immediately. I mean, at Bull Run, Confederates are carving, you know, drinking mugs out of Yankee skulls. And you can find these, you know, for sale in Southern newspapers in 62 and 63, supposedly, or rings made out of knuckle bone and things like that. So there is, I mean, and I mean, in this project, I'm trying to take a hold of both kind of what I'm thinking of as the reality of violent practice as well as the rhetoric. And you're absolutely right that both sides fuel part of their war on a rhetoric of, look how awful the other side is. They spend a great deal, a lot of that rhetoric is then implicitly meant to say, look how virtuous we are, how restrained our actions are. This is part of the trouble of just war theory, right, is that in any given conflict, both sides claim justice. Right? I mean, you know, in this sense, the origins of the Civil War are very important. It was essential that Lincoln wait for the Confederates to fire on Fort Sumter or on the Star of the West so that they are in a position of claiming defense under the laws of war. So that if you read all the early discussions, even well into 62, every kind of national, every sermon, every kind of public talk begins with cataloging what started the war so that we're in a position of absolute justice in the context of these laws of war. And then over the course of the war, the converse is look at how awful our opponents are. I guess I would say, and I think that's essential. On the other hand, there's also, I think, something that part of the rhetoric that we haven't taken account of yet is the amount of discussion among the Confederate and Union high command about the atrocities that do happen. And some of these are quite small. I mean, when Butler captures New Orleans, there's a guy killed for running a Union flag up on a hotel roof, Mumford, and he's killed. And there's one guy killed, and the correspondence about Mumford lasts for months. It gets all the way to Lee and Halleck. You know, it goes, I mean, it's across the Confederacy, it's in all the newspapers, and they're back and forth arguing about the legitimacy of the killing of this one person. And that's part of what then allows the Confederacy to put a price on Ben Butler's head, which then is used in reverse by Northerners to say, look how awful they are. But that is, a lot of the rhetoric is in fact about actual events, but they are remarkably limited in number. It's remarkable to me how much time is spent on this guy or on John Owen in Missouri who's killed, whose correspondence, there's pages and pages of the OR dedicated to this one guy all across the command structure of both armies. So rhetoric is certainly essential here in perceptions. I mean, both sides, and what I'm really interested in still haven't quite untangled is the degree to which the public of both sides, even in the midst of rhetoric about how awful the enemy is, pulls away from their own army's atrocities and examples. I mean, the episode in Missouri, I mean, the expulsion order, that's why I was asking David. I mean, I don't know what kind of northern perceptions of General Order Number 11 are. Certainly there are Confederates after the burning of Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, that say this was the wrong thing. We don't wage war this way. You know, this was part of Jubal Early's retreat from D.C. after he swung around in 64. And many soldiers in the army are deeply unhappy and quite critical of the Confederate Army for engaging in what they feel is unjust war. That is just what the Yankees do, what they've done in the Valley and all that. So do we have time for one more? Leanne, you had your hand up. Oh, well, plenty. I mean, there's a
on the formal field of battle. So, I mean, in a way, this sort of making this distinction, so much of this civilian discussion gets wrapped around with, you know, then it becomes no talk. I mean, I'm not sure if I can...
No, you're right that, I mean, there is, I mean, you know, the army is saturated in violence, much of it coercive violence directed against its participants, that is, its own soldiers. So, I mean, although I think it's probably uncommon to have an actual order saying shoot the guys that desert, deserters were frequently shot on both sides.
I guess what I want to say is that soldiers are civilians, too.
Yes, and that's, I mean, I think, you know, I guess my point would be that these atrocities exist alongside the opposite, right? I mean, the Civil War is both and. Because even as you find bloodthirsty soldiers that are willing to carve Yankee bones into knuckle rings, you get people writing home not just fatigued by violence and war, but disgusted with themselves, right, and challenging their sense of being Christians or of simply being human beings anymore. We've too long operated in kind of binaries, and you're right as well, I think, that the kind of a civilian soldier binary is less useful. Violence saturates this conflict. And so we need to think about the relationship from all these different angles. So,
Aaron Chief, thank you very much.